Hello, 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 and welcome to the Local Edition on a Friday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a packed program, so let's get straight to it. Coming up in the second half of the show, across Pennsylvania, agencies meant to protect older adults are facing new scrutiny after reporting reveals deaths during active abuse and neglect investigations. A bill in the state Senate aims to change how those cases are reviewed with new fatality review teams at the county level. Spotlight investigative reporter joins us to break down what the reporting found and what lawmakers are proposing. And also, inside a New York prison, a rare program is allowing incarcerated mothers to live with their newborns during their first months of life. We hear from a researcher on why prison nurseries like the one at Bedford Hills may have lasting benefits for both mothers and children. But before all that, it's Friday on the Local Edition, and on the phone with us now is the one and only Chris Rowley from the Shawangunk Journal, letting us know what's happening in Ulster County in Ellenville. Chris, welcome back to the show. Let's talk about grants. Yeah, you have a grant called the BRICS Grant. What can you tell us about this?
Well, this BRICS Grant is for Marbletown to refurb and partly rebuild the community center building, which is at the back of a church, a very handsome looking church front, which is built, I think, began in like 1850, that church. And behind it, there's a sort of a sprawling set of structures that have been added on since, which has been the community center. And it hosts, when it's operating, it hosts all sorts of stuff, yoga, bingo, many other kinds of activities. But it's very popular with the seniors in Marbletown. However, it is very unpopular with the town supervisor and the town board, who see it as a potential burden on the taxpayers, and they wanted to get rid of it. They've tried. This is an ongoing battle, at least three, maybe 4 years now, between the town supervisor, Rich Parody, and members of his board, facing the community members who really love this to be able to use the community center. So this is like a bomb being dropped into this thing, because now it's got a $1.3 million grant. And this is a BRICS grant, that is a building recreational infrastructure for communities, kids, and seniors grant, BRICKS, all right? And that was only submitted this summer, and then they got it. So $1.3 million will refurb the Marbletown Community Center, and the struggle will continue, because it always does. Anyway, so that's got to be that one. Then another story I've got, which is also on the Route 2 and 9 corridor, but a little closer down towards Ellenville, but it's in Cahonkson, and that is that Terry House, the town supervisor for Worsing, announced that a lot of work's been done last year, and that the submission to put sidewalks on either side of 209 in the heart of Cahonkson, where the shops are, where the diner and blah, 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 that's coming together. The DOT has got them in the crosshairs, as it were, and they're going to do it. But as Ted Houck said, he came on the board in 2004, and it began about that time that they began this process. This shows you how long it takes to get sidewalks. Mm. And we should just say, before we leave the sidewalk story, that over the mountain in Pine Bush, in the town of Crawford, which is Orange County, but, you know, there we go, they have actually done it. They have completed the sidewalk that runs along 52 in front of the Valley Supreme, which extends the village or the town sidewalks all the way down to the traffic light at Boniface Drive and the McDonald's. And that project, I can tell you, because I covered Pine Bush for a long time, that project has been in the works at least 25 years.
Wow.
And I had ritual laments, lamentation from the town board many times about when it would happen. You know, how could they get it done? Because it was dangerous. Anyway, the other side.
Did you have a lot of folks walking there to the shops and walking back home, or?
What you really have, the real problem there is you do have a few people doing that, but what you really have is you have kids from school who come down Boniface School and then cross over to McDonald's and maybe walk up into the Valley Supreme. And before the sidewalks, there was nothing, there was just The Verge, just grass. And then they put in the Dunkin' Donuts in a building that used to house something else. And that's gone because that was destroyed when a truck ran off the road and ran into it. Poor truck. Anyway, that's gone. But they're about to rebuild that with a new traffic pattern. So that whole section there in the heart of Pine Bush is being really redone, regrooved, refurbished, you know? But so it's good to see that. So anyway, and final story, this is sweet. At the Village Board Ellenville meeting on Monday, this chap, Carlos Gonzalez, came in, and he has a weekend house in Ellenville. He lives in the Bronx with his family, his wife and kid, very fun-looking daughter. However, she has OCD and has been prescribed a comfort animal, an emotional support animal. In this case, it's very small chickens, micro chickens. I had never heard of micro chickens, I got to say. They're very, very cute. Anyway, he pulled out a micro chicken to show us, and he asked if he could get a waiver because the Village of Ellenville has a ban on all fowl, no poultry is allowed. But and he had already paid a fine for having them because he didn't know about the ban. And anyway, the board looked at them. There were smiles. There was an immediate concern from the new board member, Letitia Kentoff, who's aware of all this stuff because she has a medical background, that anything that might be a trespass on the ADA makes it possible to say no. But anyway, it was a moment where we all confronted, you know, the interesting connections that come out of stuff. And the board said they would consider a waiver and they'll be discussing it in January. So right. It was a sweet ending to that.
Yeah, I'm looking up what you're talking about, these chickens. They're called Saramaras, something like that?
I think that's right, yeah. I didn't take that on board. I just took on board micro chickens.
I like the micro chickens better. The pictures I've seen, they're very cute. I mean, they obviously look like chickens, just a lot smaller. So.
Yeah, very small chickens. I know. I mean, who knew?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they lay eggs and everything else. They must be very small eggs.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's very sweet. Mr. Gonzalez is a really sweet guy, and his daughter is going to be something, I'm sure. And these chickens probably will get a waiver. But that doesn't mean that people in Ellenville can have roosters. If they came up with a rooster that didn't crow, it would be a big it would really help in spreading chickens around. That's for sure.
Well, even it's funny to say, the guy coming from the Bronx, I used to live in the Bronx, and we used to have neighbors who had roosters.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So living in a populated city, when you hear that rooster come off, I'm surprised that thing didn't get hurt or anything like that after a while. But we used to have roosters. I remember growing up for a long time, the guy had roosters. Every morning you would hear it crowing. So.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the way it could be. No, I don't remember any roosters or chickens in the East Village when I lived there. Yeah, the only noise thing I remember was there was some jerk car in the early 80s had a car with a alarm system in it, which is a little unusual then. And it would go off if you know, anybody breathed within 20 feet, and he would just let it going. And eventually he got a brick through the windscreen.
That's the city for you.
Then it moved off the road. Then we didn't see it anymore.
Well, you know, that's the city for you. So, Chris, let's leave it at there. Chris, thank you so much for talking to us. We were talking to Chris Rowley from the Schwankok Journal, letting us know what's happening in Ellenville and Ulster County. So let's move right along here. Pennsylvania's local area agencies on aging provided a wide range of services, from senior centers to transportation to meals. And one of the most important duties is investigating claims of abuse and neglect of adults age 60 or over. Reporting from Spotlight PA has found that in nearly 10 years, there has been an alarming number of older adults who die while their cases are actively being investigated. A bill introduced last month in the Pennsylvania Senate would address this issue. It proposes creating a fatality review teams at every county agencies on aging. Angela Columbus, investigative reporter for Spotlight PA, has been covering this story. Radio Catskill's Jason Dole spoke with her earlier this week.
The background on this is that at Spotlight PA, we've spent the last 18 months really looking very hard at the state system for investigating allegations of abuse and neglect and trying to see how effective they are. And, you know, we have revealed some problems that have existed in particularly how quickly these agencies investigate these very serious allegations of abuse and neglect. The Pennsylvania Department of Aging oversees 52 county area agencies on aging. These counties provide services to older adults, everything from senior centers to transportation and meals and those types of things. But one of the most important things these counties do is investigate allegations of abuse and neglect involving older adults. And in Pennsylvania, that is adults 60 and over. And under state law and regulations, these investigations have to be conducted within 20 days. And if these allegations of abuse or neglect are substantiated, then they're supposed to provide services to the older adult to help mitigate any risk, right? Either remove them from you know, the abusive situation that they're in, or provide services to help them deal with whatever problem it is that is being investigated. What we've reported, what Spotlight PA has reported, is that over the last almost 10 years, there has been an alarming number of older adults who die while their case is actively being investigated by the county area agencies on aging, which in turn raises the question of, well, why are they dying? And so that is the question, really, that these fatality review teams are being tasked to look at.
That explains how things have been done. What would be done differently now under this bill?
So under this bill, all 52 county aging agencies will have to create these fatality review teams, and they have to be to draw. The teams have to draw from different disciplines. So they have to. They can have, you know, people from the counties who do the protective services investigation. They should include law enforcement. They should include geriatricians or other physicians who have dealt with older adults and specialize in older adult care. So it really has to be kind of a multidisciplinary team that can bring different perspectives. And so once these teams get word that an older adult has died while under an active investigation, then they have to look into the circumstances of what happened. So they will have access to that person's protective services case files. They'll look at things like the cause of death. They'll try and figure out if there were any issues with the protective services investigation that occurred that maybe, you know, could have been done differently. And they then have to write up these reports that kind of summarize what happened and provide them to the Department of the State Department of Aging, which again will review them. And that way they can see, are there breakdowns in the system, really, of protecting older adults? And what can be done to fix them.
It sounds like a pretty straightforward approach to tackling a really big problem. What is the reaction to this proposal so far?
Well, the Pennsylvania Department of Aging has said that they don't believe they have the authority to require the counties to do this on their own. And so they have said that they welcome legislation at the state level to make it a requirement and to put that in black and white in the law. There is an association that actually represents the county aging agencies, and they haven't weighed in yet on this. They are still reviewing the bill. I think there have been some issues in the past that have been expressed by the counties, including, you know, this requires resources and time and, you know, potentially funding. to do the work. And, you know, there might be some counties who might view this as being burdensome or somehow not possible to execute. So the bill does provide a waiver process for those counties to apply, to basically be excluded from having to create these fatality review teams.
Oh, well, I was going to ask, was there a provision to give them funding so they could do it instead of a waiver to help them not do it?
Right. I haven't seen one yet, but, you know, again, this is a bill that is in its infancy. It has not yet even been brought up for a committee vote. So there is plenty of time to make amendments to it to maybe address those kinds of issues. But going back to the issue of the waiver, you know, just because a county applies for a waiver doesn't mean it will receive it. That decision ultimately rests with the Secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Aging, and there has to be a good reason for them to receive a waiver. You know, because if you aren't conducting quality investigations, I mean, there can be devastating consequences, right? An older adult could be left at risk of harm or even death. So, you know, the stakes are incredibly high. And I think this bill is trying to attack the problem from a different perspective, which is to kind of add an extra layer of scrutiny, at least on the back end, on how counties have been conducting their investigations.
What's the path forward for this bill? What lies ahead? You said that there's still some time, and there's going to need to be you know, some work done on it and comment and all of that. But right. What's the situation in Harrisburg? What's the culture like there? What does this bill face?
Right. Well, the legislature needs to prioritize it. There has to be an acknowledgement, particularly from the administration on down, that this is something that it wants and thinks is important and thinks the legislature should tackle immediately, right? Because the legislature works on a 2-year session, and, you know, anything that doesn't get passed in the legislature and signed into law by the governor by the end of the 2-year session, which would be at the end of next year, it has to start afresh, right? You have to start the whole process anew. So I think it'll take pressure from Governor Shapiro's administration to get it done. And I think once that pressure is there, I cannot imagine that it would be an incredibly heavy lift for the legislature to do this politically. It is not an issue that, I mean, there are obviously, you know, devil is always in the details, but as a whole, I don't think that it's a very controversial issue for them to tackle.
Has Governor Shapiro given any indication how he feels about this issue, like in general or in specific policy sense? You're saying like he hasn't weighed in on it strongly yet, but has he given any indications how he feels about this?
On this issue in particular, no. I mean, his administration has tackled aging in Pennsylvania and put out a 10-year plan, but protective services in particular for older adults has not been something that I've really heard the governor himself address. And it is, I think it's an incredibly important issue because we're talking about older adults who are more often than not, they're poor, they're marginalized, and they don't have family or friends who can help them. So these are some of the most vulnerable older adults in the state.
We've been talking to Angela Columbus, investigative reporter for Spotlight PA, who focuses on campaign finance, lobbying, departments of revenue, state general services, and her work is up now at spotlightpa.org. Angela, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your important work on this.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
For Radio Catskill, I'm Jason Dole.
Thank you, Jason, for that. You're listening to the Local Edition on a Friday evening. Stay tuned. We'll learn about nurseries in prisons. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I don't think that there is anything we can do over the next generation, no matter who becomes elected president, to make the Europeans believe that the U.S. is always going to be with them. I think the fundamental trust in the U.S. as the defender of a certain set of concepts of the West has been shattered for some time.
I'm Natalie Ketroeff. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Welcome back to The Local Edition. Friday evening, I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Across the country, more than 400 prisons hold women. Some of them are pregnant when they enter and when they give birth. Their babies are typically placed with relatives or into foster care. But in just 8 prisons nationwide, a different option exists, a prison nursery, where incarcerated mothers can adopt, where incarcerated mothers can live with their newborns. And one of those programs is in Westchester County at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility. For the first 18 months of life, babies stay with their mothers inside the facility. It might sound surprising, but research has shown lasting benefits. Dr. Lori Goshen has studied the long-term impacts of these nurseries on children. Radio Catskill's Annie Bennett has this story.
My name is Lori Goshen. I am a nurse scientist and mental health nurse practitioner.
And what has your experience been working with prison nursery programs, specifically in New York State?
Starting in about 2006, I was part of a National Institutes of Health-funded research project looking at the outcomes for women and children who participated in the New York State nursery program. My particular role was to keep in contact with moms and babies after discharge from the nursery for 3 to 5 years. So we followed the children until they reached about 5, which was amazing.
And what were some of the findings of this study?
We had some very positive findings of the study for the moms that participated. We found that the recidivism rate was much lower than you'd find in the general population. We found that for many of the moms that participated, they themselves had insecure attachment toward their primary caregivers. But when we measured attachment in the children, when they were toddlers, the children who had participated in the nursery with their moms had similar rates of secure attachment as children born to low-risk families in the community. Yeah, so that was really quite an amazing finding. And then my own dissertation looked at preschool behavior problems in the kid. I compared a measure of behavior problems between the children who had participated in the nursery and a non-equivalent comparison group of kids who had been separated from their mothers because of the mom's incarceration early in the child's life. And what I found was that children who had participated in the nursery had lower rates of certain behavior problems.
Yeah, for sure. I know there's also some opposition against prison nursery programs. Did your research sort of address any of those issues?
No, it wasn't designed to address, you know, it wasn't designed as an advocacy project.
So, for sure.
But we, you know, have encountered people who were opposed. There are a couple different types of, a couple different controversies. One is people opposed to women involved in the criminal justice system maintaining the rights to their children at all. You know, if a mother is facing these charges, then she doesn't deserve to continue in her parenting role. And that I just, you know, fundamentally disagree with. People come into contact with law enforcement and with the criminal justice system for so many different reasons, many of which don't have anything to do with their parenting role and or could be resolved with proper support. And especially as we look at all of the racism that's involved in these systems, it has fallen so disproportionately on Black and Latino women and Indigenous women too, not necessarily in New York, but other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like one group. And then there's another group of people who believe that prisons are, you know, shouldn't really house anyone or should house far fewer people, and that we should really be focusing on community support. And I guess that I'm in that group myself. So I believe that what we were able to demonstrate, you know, the outcomes of the New York State Prison Nursery supported that.
And was there anything from your research that really surprised you or really stuck out to you?
I think the thing that really stuck out to me the most was that women who had predominantly insecure attachment representations themselves and had had very difficult childhoods were able to transmit security to their own infants. And that can be transformational.
Can you explain what you mean by transmitting security and secure attachment styles? Like, what does that actually mean on an individual level?
Because of how we're parented, from very early on, we develop representations in our mind of our own deservingness of care and how predictable and caring the world will be. And, you know, that all starts with our early life caregiving. So for people who experience neglectful, harsh, unpredictable parenting, they develop a representation in their mind that the world is going to be like that and that they themselves may not be deserving of care. And so that's what we would consider an insecure attachment style. And that affects, obviously affects children, but it affects people across the life course, both in their relationship with themselves, but also in relationship with others. They are likely to parent their child in a way that may also promote in their child an insecure attachment style. But that, again, in this group of mothers, was not shown to be the case.
Right. And you mentioned that in your ideal situation, there'd be more community-based rather than within prisons. Is there anything more you want to say on that or expand as to why?
Yeah. So supportive housing is a type of community housing with wraparound services. And those services can be whatever the population in the supportive housing needs. So for example, for women involved in the criminal justice system, it could be support and adhering to their criminal justice mandates. It could be, you know, meeting with a supervision officer, having a mental health nurse practitioner like myself, having childcare supports on site. And all of this is happening in the community while also providing housing to people. Of the many things also that bring women into the criminal justice system and complicate their lives is the experience of homelessness. In this way, the intervention of supportive housing addresses the many, many, many different and complex needs that these families experience in a way that the prison nursery doesn't. What it also can do is allow for the housing of women with older children. So prison nurseries, or the prison nursery in New York, only serves a very narrow group of people. Supportive housing in the community can serve women with children from 0 to 18 and keeping them safe together in the community instead of having that period in which you take them to prison, which is a very traumatic environment and not made for children. Of course, it's not really made for anybody. And I think, you know, I don't want to look at this as an either or, like either we do prison nurseries or we do supportive housing. Ideally, we would have more supportive housing and that maybe we would also continue to have a nursery program for those special circumstances in which, for whatever reason, legal system is not going to allow the person to be in the community. So,
absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. From Liberty, I'm Annie Bennett for Radio Catskill.
That does it for the local edition on a Friday evening. Thank you so much, Annie, for that story. Actually, that's Annie's last story that she submitted to us for Radio Catskill. Her internship ended last week. So thank you, Annie and Genevieve, both of you, for great work you've done this past couple of months. So moving on to next year, we'll have new interns and more stories. Tune in on Monday for more news. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, take care of yourself, and I'll talk to you soon.
I'm Jason Tugaw, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.